When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to another episode of Tigress. I feel like I haven't spoken to y'all in a while, but I think a lot of that is because I have no concept of time anymore. I don't know if anybody else is feeling this way post-pandemic, but I feel like yesterday feels like 3 weeks ago, while also feeling like a blink of an eye ago, slash sometimes I dissociate and I don't even remember yesterday. So I feel like I haven't talked to y'all in a while, but I think it's because we have so much to catch up about. One of those things is, you know, first of all, Roe versus Wade was overturned last Friday. And so I've definitely been emotionally reeling from that in the sense that, you know, so much of my work is around reproductive rights and reproductive freedoms. And I have worked in legislative advocacy for several years now, even as like a passion of mine. And I think what's really fascinating or eye-opening for me is that in doing all of the legislative work, one of the reasons that I'm really passionate about it is because it feels so permanent, right? When you have legislative wins, that is a permanent win. It feels like a systemic change. And I think one of the heartbreaking things about Roe versus Wade being overturned is that it feels like kind of a disruption of that feeling of systemic change being more permanent and being something that is protected. And I feel like with Roe versus Wade being overturned, I'm at least feeling like if our rights can be taken away at any point while we're also fighting within the same system that is fighting us, what progress are we really making? And is progress always going to be something that we're protecting with our lives, or it's going to be backtracked? That's honestly what it feels like. So I feel like for me, the concept of time has really been warped both because of being in a post-pandemic world where we're slowly getting out into the, you know, real world, you know, not quarantined. Also because social media has a whole other different warped time thing. And of course, the headlines every single day just are so exhausting. Like Roe versus Wade being overturned, mass shootings, like it's just exhausting. And so for me, I've definitely been sleeping a lot more. As y'all know, it's been a really long journey of working through insomnia, and I've been in such a good place of sleeping like 8 hours a day. Lately, that's been more like a 10 to 12 hour a day thing, and I still wake up feeling really tired. I think it's more of an emotional thing. I definitely went through like a little bit of a depressive episode after Roe versus Wade was overturned. And I think a lot of that was just like waking up every day. Usually my habits are, you know, checking my phone, checking the news. I always listen to the daily podcast by the New York Times. And it was just like everywhere I turned, more depressing things. So I honestly don't know anybody who was not going through some sort of depressive episode over the last week. But overall, I'm feeling thankful for the communities that I do have, because I think that the solidarity that I have found online, the sisterhood that I found in my own friendships have been what is keeping me afloat. And that is something that I am very thankful for. Now, something we've talked about quite a bit on the podcast, and especially over the last couple years of the pandemic and seeing the anti-Asian violence and hate crimes be on a rise, is Asian American identity. For those of you who cannot see me on video right now, you might not know that I am Asian. I have a very Asian last name. My last name is Okamoto, which is very Japanese. I've been told that Okamoto is like Smith, but in Japanese. So it is a very common last name. But, you know, for me, Asian American identity is something that I've always really struggled with. I grew up feeling really ashamed of being Asian because of being teased and bullied for it, and or objectified for it. I think similarly, I have never felt truly in touch with my own heritage, whether that be culturally of understanding Japanese or Taiwanese culture. I also am not really close with family members who are still there. I have many, many cousins on both sides, both in Taiwan and Japan, and I'm not close with them. I'm not on speaking terms with them. My grandparents disowned me. That's a whole other podcast episode if you want to scroll down a few episodes back. And I'm not in touch with my dad, who was born in Japan. So I think for me, my identity racially, culturally has always been something that I've really struggled with. And it really has been only in the last year, couple years of studying Asian American sociology for the first time in my life and connecting with other Asian American activists who have been actively fighting for more representation and racial equality in the context of identifying as Asian American that I feel like I've started to really understand what it means to me to be Asian American. And that answer is very fluid. That is something that I will constantly be searching for and trying to define, I think, for the rest of my life. But it is something we're going to be talking to today with my guest, Jeannie J. Park, who is someone I've been connected to on social media for maybe over a year now. She really, I started to get to know her work in the summer of 2020 when she was organizing with Warriors in the Garden, which is a New York City based activist group that was founded by a group of, I think, 12 different activists who were in the Black Lives Matter movement. One of them being a childhood friend of mine, Livia Rose Johnson. And so through following Livia, I connected with Jeannie and then started following her and have just been so blown away with how she's created space for herself as an Asian American activist, as an advocate for Black and Asian solidarity, as an advocate to talk about mental health and sustainability. And she's also a model. And if you haven't seen her on social media, definitely go check her out. But I recently met up with her for the first time in person and was just honestly blown away by the way she thinks about and reflects on Asian American identity. So with that, welcome Jeannie.
Geico asks, how would you love a chance to save money on your insurance? Of course you would. After all, who wouldn't love a great deal, right? And when it comes to great rates on insurance for all of the things in your life, Geico can help. Like with insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, and RV. Even help with homeowners, condo, or renters coverage. You could save even more with a special discount when you bundle your coverages. Plus, add the easy-to-use Geico mobile app, available 24-hour roadside assistance, and more. And choosing to switch to Geico becomes an easy choice. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote or contact your local agent and get started seeing how much you could save.
This show is part of the Pro Democracy Podcast Coalition. I think most of us agree that in a functioning democracy, the winner should be determined by the voters. Well, that almost didn't happen in 2020. Now extremists are working to intimidate and replace nonpartisan election workers with quote-unquote yes men who might reject election results. The only thing that will stop them is us. We've partnered with the grassroots pro-democracy organization, Represent Us, to give you the tools you need to protect free and fair elections. Learn more and get involved. Visit represent.us/pod to learn more. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
For the friends of ours who are listening and not watching, they might not know you're Asian, but we know you're Asian.
We know we're Asian.
What is your racial ethnic background?
I am first generation Korean American. My parents were both born in South Korea and immigrated here the year I was born.
Okay. And you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a sister. She's a year older than me. She's also Asian.
Surprise! I always ask about siblings, I think, because I feel like at least for me as an Asian American oldest sibling, sibling roles are very much a thing.
Yeah.
Like various East Asian cultures especially, I think because there's this whole respect of the elders and hierarchy that naturally
it's
happens.
Such hierarchy and it's a filial piety.
Yeah, even like who eats first.
Yeah.
Where you're placed on the family portrait, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm the baby of the family, so I got the least attention.
Do you feel like right now you identify really strongly as a Korean American or more as like an Asian American?
This is a really good question. I feel like I teetered between, in the beginning, I wanted to come, you know, we know the term Asian American was coined in the 60s during the Asian Civil Rights Movement by four Asian women scholars at UCLA as an attempt to build interracial solidarity. Yeah. So kind of when I started doing this organizing work, I really wanted to come from a place of building solidarity. But then I felt that that term became such a blanketing term.
Yeah.
And such a monolithic thing to really flatten us all into one. And so now I like to be very specific about the fact that I'm Korean American, because I think our experiences are so diverse, and you know, there's 44 countries in Asia.
Yeah.
But in America, it's Asian is syndicated to Chinese, Korean, or Japanese.
Yeah.
And I also think we saw in the way that, you know, we kind of all got scapegoated, regardless of the fact of whether we're Chinese, that with this anti-Chinese sentiment from the coronavirus, it was just all Asians.
Yeah. And I think also in the 20th century, we saw that with a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment. Yeah. So this is not new. Not new at all.
Yes.
So
take notes, children. Learn your history.
Right before, when we were doing the intro, I was kind of talking about how I came to know you really a couple years ago when you started organizing with Warriors in the Garden. But where was that the beginning, or where was that in your organizing journey?
So I feel like me starting to organize was kind of the final straw on just a lifetime of suppressing my Asian American identity, my Korean identity. And really in college is when I you know, changed my major halfway through to Asian American studies. I need to learn the history of my people. Because I felt so lost in terms of, I felt like I had no connection to my roots, but I had also spent, you know, 23 years running away from them. Mm-hmm. I tried to be so white growing up. I was the banana, the ideal banana, and the ideal, like, model minority. And so I think organizing was also just so healing for me, to really reckon and awaken to, you know, radical, almost Asian awakening and pride from such self-hatred and repression.
So the organizing was really kind of 2020.
Yeah,
right?
That was 2020. We, Warriors in the Garden, you know, came together during the summer of the George Floyd protests. And it's an organization that is Black liberation focused, but committed to eradicating all forms of white supremacy. You know, we recognize how things like the model minority myth and the depiction of Asian Americans in media today is also being used as a juxtaposition to further perpetuate anti-Blackness and exacerbate the tensions between our two communities. So we really wanted to come from a place of bridging those gaps and also telling the history of this solidarity that is very erased from history textbooks. We see, you know, it's like no one knows this, but two founding members of the Black Panther Party were fully Japanese American. Mm-hmm. And you see from all the way back to Frederick Douglass speaking out against the Chinese Exclusion Act, to Yuri Kochiyama, to Grace Lee Boggs, to really all of these figures that have paved the way for us to be here today. It was really empowering, I think, for me to learn. And I really didn't learn this history until I started organizing. Mm-hmm. I had touched on it in college, but really getting into it and reading also, you know, the novels and the books and the studies that a lot of these activists left for us to build upon. And yeah, I think it's, I think, oh, my earring just failed. I get sad because I think about, in one way, how I feel like I've kind of only gotten to know my Asian identity based on tragedy. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is so telling of the Asian American experience, that the racism we face is so silenced and almost subliminal that it took such violence and death for people to validate it. Mm-hmm. And still, even with that validation, we don't really see the needle moving.
Yeah. I mean, I think I similarly did not know, and I was very uneducated about Asian American sociology and history. And I still very much have a lot of learning to do, but it is crazy to think about how it really wasn't until late 2020 when I was doing like my own accountability work of being like, what is the model minority myth? Like, I've always known this term model minority, but I didn't understand how being a model minority was bad or how it was related at all to anti-blackness or how it was created by like a white supremacist system. And even the names like Yuri Kochiyama and Grace Lee Boggs are not names that ever came up in school. Even in like my intro Asian American sociology class, I don't think it came up. I think I remember hearing about like Vincent Chin and hearing about overall anti-Japanese sentiment during the war and hearing about like Chinese railroad workers. But I don't think any of these like pillar figures were included in a lot of even those like intro classes.
Yeah.
And it is crazy because like the more you study it, you realize how prominent those voices were, especially in like all racial equality work and even in the reimagining capitalism work. So, I mean, I'm right there with you. I feel like the last couple of years have just been like catching up in a lot of ways. But I feel like for me, I look at you and I feel like press and social media, you have this profile of being a very proud Asian Korean American. And you absolutely are.
Yes.
But it also doesn't sound like it was always like that.
No.
Right? So, are you good? Oh, yeah. So, growing up, you were that Asian girl, that banana.
That Asian girl.
That Asian girl, banana life. Very much identify with that, which is the yellow on the outside, white on the inside. And I feel like for me, so much of my being teased growing up was about my eyes, my looks. I remember people would say that my vagina would smell more fishy, and that was always an insecurity I had.
Yeah.
So for me, I feel like I also grew up feeling really ashamed of it. But and so I'm curious to know a little bit more about like your experience. Where did you grow up, and like what was your relationship with your racial identity growing up?
It took me so goddamn long to get here. Like, fuck. Oh my God. I don't know. I was born in Los Angeles, in Long Beach, California. And then I moved to New Jersey in Bergen County, which is like 45 minutes away from here. Very white, very suburban, very Vineyard Vines, Vera Bradley, you name it, we got it. And it's funny because it's actually a very Korean dominated part of New Jersey, but it was so segregated in the ways that the Asian kids hung out with the Asian kids, the Korean kids hung out with the Korean kids, and I didn't even feel accepted by the Korean kids because I never fit that like Korean mold from a really young age. I was always a bad Korean.
What is a good Korean?
I don't know. A good Korean is someone who goes to Hagwon, who goes to, you know, the...
What is Hagwon?
Hagwon is like after school.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever go to after school?
I went to Kumon.
Kumon.
Yeah.
Kumon is Hagwon.
Yeah.
I don't know. I went to that shit every day after school until I was like 16.
So you were a good Korean.
Yeah, but I would skip all the time. Mm,
okay.
And I wasn't good at math. And I realized I wasn't good at math. Like, I hit middle school. I was like, this is not my jam. Everything my mom made me do, I quit. Piano, ice skating, violin. My mom made me play the harp. She was like, if you play the harp, you'll, because she realized I was a bad Asian from a young age. So it was so funny. She was like, she can't play the piano that well. She can't. She, what are we going to do? Yeah. The harp. If she plays the harp, she'll go to harp. No one else plays the harp, Jeannie. Yeah. She'll go to Harvard.
Because the orchestra will need a harpist.
There's no other, no one else plays the harp. So that was her solution. Yeah, that lasted like 6 months.
Did you speak Korean at home?
Yeah, I speak like Konglish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Konglish?
Konglish. I don't know. It's broken Korean English because, yeah. I mean, my Korean was good when it was, when I was a lot younger, and I grew up going to Korea every year because the rest of my family is still there. But now it's, you know, I lost the tongue.
Do you feel like you had a lot of community in the Korean community? Like, you had Korean friends, you were going to Korean after school?
Not really. And for me, my Korean identity when I was younger was really closely tied with the church. Because I grew up in such a traditionally religious, you know, Korean household. And I was like, get me out of this shit.
Yeah.
No. And I think I recognized from a really young age that I didn't want to follow these boxes and rules that the world lays out for us. But I also fell into them anyway on my own. But it was definitely this fear that the only way I could make myself seen was to be like the only one in the room. And I think that this dynamic is one that still shows up in my life. It is literally only recently that I have a lot of Asian friends. Mm. I have never in my life, I've never dated an Asian person. I've never been comfortable until recently surrounding myself with my community.
Yeah.
Because I felt like it made me look so Asian.
And you didn't want to look Asian. Why?
Because I wanted to be accepted. And I wanted to...
By white people.
Yeah, and I was teased. I mean, I was teased for my whole life from as young as I can remember. But not even teased, like bullied, physically attacked, harassed every day of my life for being Asian. I would go home. I wouldn't be able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. My parents told me to keep my head down, to be grateful for what I'm given, even if it's only the scraps. You know, we're guests in this country. I think for them too, being immigrants, it wasn't, they've always, their generation have very much, I think, assumed the model minority boxes. And yeah, I think about some of the shit that happened to me when I'm younger and I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I think it's just like this. There was this boy in middle school who every day would tease me about like my eyes, like the smell of me, like everything, the lunchbox, everything, head to toe. And one day my mom caught him leaving like a dead bird in our mailbox, and it had a little packet of soy sauce attached to it.
Oh my God.
And this is so, like, it's fucking hilarious now I think about it and I laugh at it. But it's also so traumatic that I would have gone through that when I was in second, third grade.
Yeah.
And that it also would have been so brushed under the carpet. And I think, you know, these experiences happening to me so much compounded with the fact that my parents didn't really open that space for these conversations to be had. I literally was never told that. I didn't learn about Asian people being discriminated against. I didn't learn the history of it. I wasn't told. Like, I literally thought I was white. That's insane.
Yeah.
I am not white.
Yeah.
I have never been white. I will never be white. I mean, you know, yeah.
When your mom saw that boy putting the dead bird in your mailbox, what was her reaction? Was there a conversation about it?
No. She
just threw it away.
Yeah. And we didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the trauma even of that is, I mean, it's the model minority myth, like kind of the harm that it does on Asian Americans or just Asian people in this country in general is like, you are the ones who are good at math. You're statistically the ones that have a closer income, higher proximity to whiteness.
Yeah.
And we see our like black and brown brothers and sisters and siblings who are being ridiculed for things that I don't want to say are much worse, but feel much worse, right? Like, oh, they're making fun of me for being good at math. They're making fun of me for, you know, being good at doing piano, you know, things that, but at the same time, these very traumatic things, like I smell bad, I'm ugly, my eyes are small, you know, things that absolutely are so traumatic as well. I mean, I think something I was always really thankful for is like, I'm second generation Chinese, first generation Japanese. And my mom talked about everything. So we dissected everything. We didn't talk about the history, but we talked a lot about like, why is this bad? How are you feeling? There was a lot of therapy.
Yeah.
So when do you think that, you know, coming from maybe a household where you weren't talking about the bullying or what you're going through, when did you kind of have that light bulb moment of like, wait, I'm not white. I'm, you know, I am Asian and that this is bullying?
Literally.
2 years, 2020.
Like, yeah. I mean, not even, because I remember 2020, the beginning of the pandemic, we started seeing anti-Asian hate crimes. I was speaking out about it. I was getting gaslit left and right. People were literally shutting me down. But that is also the model minority myth doing its dirty work of telling us to shut up, sit down, be quiet, and listen. That, you know, we are wealthy, white, Ivy League educated Americans, that we are accepted, that because we've kept our head down and we've been quiet and we've worked hard enough that we've made it. This is, where are we? And I think that moment where I really started realizing, like, even if I've played along all these rules. I literally lied. I played into it so deep that took me 22 years to come to that realization and to start loving myself for who I really am. And I think that is what the model minority myth is. I think that's what it does. And, you know, in the sphere of white supremacy, it's this crazy, like, I see the model minority myth as such a tying yet invisible thread that keeps white supremacy going.
How would you describe the model minority myth to like someone who's never heard of it before?
The false depiction that Asian people are white.
Yeah.
Like, to put it simply.
And well off.
Yeah. And it erases also, I mean, this is why we have such a monolithic view of what Asian American is right now. It's really only Eastern Asian. That's what people recognize. But
and wealthy.
Yeah, Eastern, well-educated, wealthy, like crazy rich Asians. That's what I think of. I think of these depictions and the media portrayal of Asian Americans right now. Bling Empire, it completely invalidates and erases an entire working class. And it is actually not very well known that Asian Americans, out of all minority groups in America, we have the highest wealth disparity, the highest wealth gap. So, and it is also the undocumented Asians, the South Asians, Black and Brown Asians, queer Asians, disabled Asians. These people are all getting erased when we only look at Asian in this narrow perspective of what the model minority myth allows us to see. And for me, it's, yes, about getting people to learn about it and understand the racism that we faced, but it's also about, like, how do we detangle these web? How do I really, like, how do I detangle the conditioning that I've undergone throughout my whole life up till this point under this myth? And that is really where I think that is the first step of how I believe I play a part in dismantling the systems of white supremacy in the grander scheme.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about how it starts with us, that is, for me, it took me a really long time, and I'm still trying to understand the place that I assumed within the system and like the webs of and labyrinth of white supremacy and how I fed into that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like, it's so crazy because I completely relate to, I mean, dealing with comments where you grow up as a child being teased for your race and for being Asian and yet also being told that you're basically white. And like,
yeah, it's confusing. So confusing. Like, I don't know how to process that. Yeah. All.
And they're like, even now on social media, like if I ever, when every time I talk about like anti-Asian violence, people are like, bro, you're literally white. Like,
yeah, this is the biggest reach of discrimination I've ever seen.
Yeah, so many comments from like white girls who are like, my skin is literally darker than yours. I'm like, you have a spray tan. Like, but first of all, like that's not what we're talking about here. But
no,
which, you know, feeds also into like the whole colorism thing within the Asian American community. But, you know, a lot of the model minority myth, like it was a constructed thing by white owned media. Yeah. Like I remember it's fascinating for me, like looking through old like Time magazine covers where it's like the Japanese nerdy whiz kids, the ones who are like your biggest competitions for white people. But I think it's
so scary.
A lot of my learning recently was also like reading into like, okay, how does this also at its core also harm our Black communities, right? And you've been doing so much of your organizing work also kind of in the context also of Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd protests. How do you feel like you were able to approach those, that scene, right? Where so much of the focus, even from a media perspective, was about Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And foster that element of like, you know, interracial community and solidarity. Yeah. And also something I've been honestly always nervous about is like taking up space, but not too much space. And I feel like going back to the idea of like, what is a good Asian? Like
a good Asian doesn't take up,
does not take up any space.
Any space.
Yeah. Especially as an Asian woman.
Yeah.
So how did you approach that? Like in 2020, like everybody's talking about Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, but also rising anti-Asian violence and your organizing.
I mean, I feel like I ended up in that space because one, I saw such a white space as soon as I got on the ground of solidarity between our two communities. And actually, beyond that, just tensions.
Yeah.
You know, it was, I remember like the first rally that was organized, the first big rally after Atlanta that was organized here in New York, it was Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang was at the center of that rally and he pulled up with so much NYPD. At a march that the organizers of and, you know, had invited us Warriors in the Garden to come speak, specifically the Black women in our organization, to touch on solidarity. But they're not going to put the care of understanding why when you invite a Black-led abolition-focused organization to a march that, to a rally that is, the police is present at, how you're directly putting those women in danger. And I also saw such a white space in on the ground after Atlanta for just Asian women on the mic taking up space. And that pissed me the fuck off because it was just a bunch of Asian men. It was very, and I think the grassroots Asian American space has also very much always been patriarchally dominated. And that's a whole other, you know.
It's like many Asian cultures.
Yeah. And it's very, I mean, that was so enraging to me because all I needed, and I could see it in the eyes of so many, you know, Asian sisters next to me, of all that we needed was to hear from someone who looked like us, who was feeling the pain of what it meant to be an Asian woman in America on that day. And so for me, it was, that's really what just propelled me. And the more I started doing this work, the more I realized that the anti-Asian hate crimes are being presented in the media right now in a way to push more policing, mass policing, and to further exacerbate tensions between Black and Asian folks. You know, it's like what you said about the media only portraying photos of the Black perpetrators of these crimes. When you, if you look at the data, if you look at the numbers, it is mostly predominantly white folks who are attacking Asian people in this country right now. Yeah, you turn on the news, completely different story. But they're exacerbating tensions that they already know exist that we also haven't really been taught about. So I feel like all of this was happening subconsciously under us. And I studied Asian American studies. I studied critical race theory. I studied, you know, what I could find about the history of how the African American civil rights movement and Asian American civil rights movement worked together in the 60s. And, you know, we sat down at the table, and because at the end of the day, when Atlanta happened and when hate crimes were happening, specifically against Asian women, Black women were there for me. They understood what that felt like. They also understood what it feels like to organize in a movement where they get erased, you know, where they're literally discriminated by Black men leading those movements too and erased. So I think it's, at the end of the day, the intersections of the racism and the sexualization that we face really renders us in such an invisible place. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to what you say about like how a good Asian woman does not take up space. And that's something we've learned. That's something I've learned from watching my mom, to the TV I've ingested, to the books I've read, to just the world we've grown up in. And I was just like, no more.
Have you had conversations with your parents about organizing?
Mm-hmm.
Have they come to your protests?
My mom has. And yeah, I think I've radicalized my mom a little bit, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
But, you know, I understand that my parents come from a generation, and also my grandparents, and they all came from a country that, where they went through so much imperialism and war and colonization. And I, for a really long time, I think I held also a lot of judgment towards my family for believing these things, and, you know, for having anti-Black views, for having homophobic, transphobic views. But it's coming from a place of really understanding why they think the way they think that I think has allowed for the most space to be created, for there to be not such stark polarization, but for us to actually be able to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's been a long journey. I'm sure you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for, like, I keep talking about, I feel like I'm finding more answers about what it means to be Asian American. But also, like, the more I think about it, the more I'm like, well, it means so many things. So it kind of means nothing. You know, like,
yeah.
It's kind of whatever you want it to mean.
Because, yeah.
I mean, as you said, like, historically, even the term Asian American, it was created, you know, in the 60s. Honestly, Asian American was created as a term to create solidarity with non-Asian oppressed communities.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even about like the Asian American experience.
It was never about defining us.
No, it was about like defining solidarity to other groups.
Yeah.
And then I think similarly, like, there are all these different paradoxes, as you said, like, how do I assimilate while I'm also being, you know, teased?
Yeah.
How do I establish that I am not white while also being in a system where the model minority myth says I'm basically white?
Yeah.
You know, there are all these different paradoxes. Or like, even I think for me, like, on paper, I've like when people read my resume, like or like they introduce me, usually their first reaction is like, wow, your like grandparents must be so proud of you. And I'm like, my grandparents disowned me because I was not Chinese enough.
Yeah.
When in reality, I'm like on paper, like I went to Harvard. I'm like financially independent. Like I'm a fucking homeowner. Like they're all these things that you would think that make them really proud. But it's like, no, but because I did that by being a loud person, I'm a bad Asian. I'm a bad Chinese granddaughter. Yeah. I am a disownable, you know, dishonorable. And so it's all these different paradoxes that I just think are just so that are confusing.
That's why you just got to throw that shit, wrap it all up and throw it out the window. Fuck it all.
And then how do you,
it's like, how do you, for me, it's like, because I relate to that so much, like, even if on paper everything you're doing is perfect, I was never good enough because I was never quiet enough. And I am a very loud person. Like, bitch, I was born this way. I'm a fucking Leo. I'm a double Leo. There's two double Leo in my chart. Like, you're not going to shut me up. And that was very early on. Like, my parents literally, like, put me in, like, Taekwondo. They were like, you know, neutralize her. Neutralize her.
Get all the energy out.
Yeah, take it out. Neutralize her. And even, I mean, it's painful because I wish my parents were proud of what I was doing and what I'm trying to create with community organizing. But speaking up against racism is very non-Asian. It's just, it's a bad thing to do to my parents. To them, it's like, I remember the conversations we had when we first saw these hate crimes happening. It was like, oh, like, honestly, and the saddest part was that it didn't surprise them. They were like, this is just the way things are. But, you know, recently my mom did say something to me about how all, my ability to resist and speak out is also a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is really the ultimate sacrifice of what I feel like my parents have sacrificed. And the privilege that they've had, the privileges that they've given me. And I truly believe that this is how I exercise them.
Yeah.
And because it is so many of the things that I speak out against, like my mom grew up in a society where it didn't validate it as wrong, you know? And so I think she just, it's the privilege of growing up also in a society at the end of the day that as much as they tell you to assimilate, you know, we've seen allyship and solidarity from communities and sorry, I'm brain farting.
No, I totally hear what you're saying. And I think about this a lot with my grandparents because I remember talking to them about the anti-Asian violence and they're like, oh, but it's because Black people are racist. Like, they're much more conservative. They're Trump supporters.
Yeah, same.
But it was really fascinating because it kind of minimized the idea that anti-Asian violence was, like, really a thing.
Yeah.
Like, as a societal issue, it was more like, oh, it's a Black and Asian issue.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, my grandparents have been living here for 50 years or something. They're still very, you know, what they would people would call, like, fob, like, fresh off the boat, like, very thick accents. They social cues are not, you know, they definitely draw a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And they live in Indiana and walking around with them, like my initial emotion is like feeling embarrassed because the way they're interacting with other people, the accents and the way they're talking at people, you know, very like in your face.
Yeah.
Like people look at them weird. People judge them. People say mean things. And for me, it's easy to be like, why don't they realize that they're being mistreated? Why aren't they saying anything? Why do they just pretend everything's fine and then blame it on someone else, blame it on Black people, right? And a lot of it is, that is the model minority myth at work. But also I kind of recognize, like, it's a survival mechanism, right? Yeah. Like, they got here as poor Taiwanese Americans during the Chinese Exclusion Act, by the way. Yeah. And were getting jobs at white institutions.
Yeah.
And if you said anything, you would not have a job, right? So I do think it is this like idea of like a good Asian is someone who keeps their head down, is survival mode and is trying to work in this white man's world of make money, move up the hierarchy, higher education. And a lot of that value on education is the fucking Chinese Exclusion Act, which only made exceptions for higher education.
Yeah.
Like people who are coming to pursue.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's fucking insane. I mean, you think about that, you think like a decade later after that, it was the Anti-Prostitution Act of 1890, which barred any Asian woman from coming onto American land out of suspicion that they were, like, under the assumption that Asian women are prostitutes, are war-torn mail order brides.
Yeah.
Under that assumption. And that's, you know, is a picture that very much the media at the time helped paint. And we see how those abuses of power are still alive today. You know, you saw the way the media reported just on the Atlanta shooting, on how they glamorized the killer and his excuse of, I was having a bad day.
Well,
to be a good Asian means to be their bad day, like their exotic dream.
Yeah.
Especially to be a good Asian woman, to be a good Asian woman in America.
It was like very servile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You serve. It's so, to me, like submission has been my survival mechanism. Yeah. It is one that I learned, I was conditioned under my mother. And it is one that is generations deep and old from way before our families even came to America. Because it's so, you know, Asian cultures in general are so patriarchal. Women aren't unequal humans.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it is very servile even then. And actually, it's really funny because when I started dating my current boyfriend, who is white, I've always had like a really big insecurity that like white guys would only be into me because I'm Asian and like not because they were attracted to me. And like I've dated some people where that very much was the case and some who are not. But because it's such an insecurity. And he's from Switzerland, and so he never learned about U.S. history or any of this.
Yeah.
And I made him watch multiple documentaries with me about, like, the history of the fetishization of Asian women because I was like, you need to understand where this insecurity comes from and have language for it. But, okay, so I have one more question for you. We have so many episodes to do because there's so much to talk about, but...
I know. I feel like we only touched on, like, the first bullet point from our list.
The one thing I wanted to ask you about is, like, so much of the stereotyping and like the disrespect, I'll say disrespect of Asian women is around like the objectification of our bodies. A lot of the teasing growing up is about the way we look and the idea of like feeling attractive, being pretty for an Asian girl, all of that. How do you feel like you've grown now that you are a literal model?
Backwards and upwards, for sure.
Okay.
I feel like my experiences in the industry have provided a very compelling and holistic lens, I think, for all of these dynamics of fetishization that I learned about for so many years. And it was kind of the culmination of just really out front, you know, monolithic stereotyping and, you know, being booked for Chinese New Year campaigns. Mm. Like 100% Korean. That doesn't matter because we're all the same. We're all the same.
Okay.
The amount of times I've walked onto a set and literally been asked to like head to toe be transformed into a geisha for editorial purposes. But not understanding how, I guess, harmful it is to continue glamorizing comfort women in this day and age,
mm-hmm.
especially Asian women. So I think it's empowered me and it's also disempowered me. It was really until, like, I would say the last year when I started also feeling like I could take up space in my own career,
mm-hmm.
I think as models, we're literally just props. We're props. We're propped up mannequins. We're told where to go, where and when. Like, I have never been really involved in the creative process of any project I've been involved in until I have thrown my body into that room, been like, hello,
yeah,
listen to me. But I think just fashion in general has also been like a chosen lens for me to understand the systems of oppression that we face. Because it's also, you know, the way Asian models get hypersexualized and fetishized on set and harassed mimics the way this industry has built itself to this size off of the labor of Asian women, Asian hands, off of our backs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I wrote a whole paper about how the climate crisis and sustainability in fashion is connected to anti-Asian racism.
We love.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Period. That's so cool. And how whitewashed the sustainability and kind of environmental movement, the mainstream environmental movement in America has become, is really directly interconnected with an agenda of anti-Asian racism.
I know that I think you're beautiful. Thank you. Do you feel beautiful?
On most days, no. But I'm working to get there. I'm gonna be super honest. Like,
yeah.
I wake up most days and I have to look at myself for 10 minutes when I wake up in the morning, doing affirmations, telling myself that I fucking love myself.
Yeah.
In order to feel some type of safety and comfort in my own skin. I feel like I've been backtracking so much for like the last few years, because it's almost like I feel like I'm only starting to like live for the first time. Because I'm embracing an identity that I, you know, ran away so heavily from my whole life. And I always say, like, if I could just get one other girl to learn to, in this, growing up in this country, to not take 22 years to learn to love herself, then my job is done.
We love. Well, you definitely have done that, so maybe you can retire now. I'm so excited for many future episodes because we have so much to talk about.
Yes, much more to come.
But come back next week, because next week we'll also be with Jeannie, because we have so much to talk about.
Yes.
And we'll link all your socials. And yeah, we'll see you soon.
I'll see you guys then.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.